I believe that being well off isn't the same as living well. That's the Money Mind Shift with Dr. Tom Matar. Hi and welcome. I'm Tom Matar. People in the office, they call me Dr. Tom because I am a behavioral scientist and I have a strong interest in financial psychology. I'm really keen to help people make better long-term decisions for themselves. But I really think this is something that many of us are finding so hard, right? Finding it so hard to make good decisions for themselves. So this is our new podcast. We call it Money Mind Shift. And the core belief in Money Mind Shift is that financial success is as much mindset as it is mechanics. Now, there's plenty of stuff out there on the mechanical side of financial planning, like how to, you know, budget and how to deal with debt and all this stuff. There's not so much, though, on the mindset side. So here we are. We will talk about money. We'll talk about money choices, but not in numbers, but in values, in relationships, in identities, and things that, you know, matter to you and helping you really to live the life you want with the resources that you have. Now, in this podcast, what we do is we're going to talk to a wide range of thinkers, of experts. And in the pipeline, we have a few podcasts for you that are really there to help you plan better financially. But this is a podcast really about you, and I want you to get involved, right? So I want you to tell me what you'd be interested in. So let us know what you'd like me to explore. I bet there are a few things that immediately come to mind, things like budgeting, debt management, understanding mortgages and pensions, all that sort of stuff. But I think there's something deeper that often goes unexplored. What's often missing is a recognition that being good with money isn't just about what you know. It's about how well you know yourself, your habits, your fears, your beliefs, your goals, what makes you happy, that type of stuff. Because we don't explore the emotional and psychological side of money, we risk living reactively rather than intentionally. But before we go into this topic, and coming up will be Dr. Daniel Crosby, author of The Soul of Wealth. As always, we must go down the rabbit hole. Okay, here we are down the rabbit hole, and I want to think briefly about money personalities. This is a question I'll ask Daniel. And I think it is a really good question to reflect on, because part of money personalities is your beliefs about money, your attitudes, your emotional reactions, and all those things. And they determine really a lot about what you do day in and day out, how you choose to earn money, how you choose to spend money, how you choose to manage money, all those things. There are different types of money personalities. There's the saver, there's the spender, there's the investor, there's the giver. There are a number of personalities, and you know, there's different concepts, different people speaking about different personalities. I guess, you know, reflecting on my own personality, I'm probably closest to the saver. I'm perhaps closest to putting money aside for one future point. And what I find interesting, I have children, a boy and a girl. And what I find interesting, they're 9 years old, they're twins. And what I find interesting is that the girl, she is very much a saver already. So they both get the same amount of pocket money. She's very much the sort of like, I save this for a later day. When my son, he knows very much like what he would want to use the money for. And it's funny, I, as the sort of, money guru in the household, I try to encourage my daughter to spend the money, because after all, you know, she's got the money for a reason. I try to encourage my son to save a bit more of that money, because, you know, after all, he probably will have some sort of, you know, bigger goals. So there you have it. You know, you have examples of money personality, and you have examples of how they, you know, determine what you do in everyday life. And this is why I think it is a good question to ask and reflect on. Right, let's get into the show. I get out of the rabbit hole.
Would you say that you're good with money?
I would say so. I mean, yes. I am still quite young, so there's not many things I need to splash the cash out on just yet. So I don't have like that many responsibilities.
I don't think I'm good with money. And I think that is probably kind of a common theme between me and my friends in our 30s, because it wasn't really discussed at school, wasn't taught at school. Yeah. I think also growing up, you kind of, you wanted to spend it on luxuries as soon as you got that kind of excitement of a salary in your 20s, say, and then, you know, you started to think about budgeting. I think I didn't prioritise it enough, and then that's when it comes back to bite me a little bit, that I didn't prioritise.
Would you say that you are good with money?
Yes. I think I am quite good with money. I suppose growing up, then my parents were quite good at sort of teaching us.
Yes and no. Like, I don't think I'm the worst, but I'm not one of those people who has like everything in a spreadsheet and knows exactly how many, like down to the pence, how much you can spend each month. But I think overall, I'm not an overspender, I'd say.
Would you say that you're good with money?
I would say so, yeah. So like when I get paid, so I still live with my parents and I pay digs. So I pay that off, then pay like bills off, and then I'll put like a couple hundred away in my savings, and then I know like I've got this left. Like I've still leaving myself enough money to go out and enjoy myself with my friends. It's nice to have savings as a backup just in case like you've got so much to pay for that month. So then you can maybe just nip in, but you can replace it back the next month afterwards when you've not got so much on. Like turning 24 this year, and it's like just want to get myself like sorted, because I know I'm not getting any younger, and time does fly in when you have a good time. So just need to get it sorted, definitely.
Yeah.
To discuss how to be good with money, behavioral psychologist and financial thinker, author of New York Times best-selling books, including The Behavioral Investor and his most recent Soul of Wealth, 50 Reflections on Money and Meaning, we welcome Dr. Daniel Crosby.
Thomas, great to be with you.
I wanted to ask you this question, I suppose. What does it mean to be good with money?
Well, I think we have to almost begin with a counterexample, because I think the way that most people think of it, of being good with money, would be strictly in a technical sense. You know, being good with money in most people's minds would mean knowing how to budget, knowing how to spend, save, invest. And that is indeed a piece of it. Yes. But the whole premise of in my work is that there's a world beyond the technical aspects of money. And that being good with money entails using money to gain insights into your own behavior, to create a life that allows you to express the gift and live the life that only you can live, to live a life of meaning and purpose. As I've explored that world, I've come up with what I call the three B's of a meaningful life, and it's believing, belonging, and becoming. You know, the research shows that people who live a life of flourishing, first of all, they have a belief in something. They have an idea of what a good life and what a good world looks like. Mm. And so part of it is using money to fund bring about the world that you want to live in, a world that's consistent with your beliefs about what a good world and a good life is. You know, the second one is belonging. This is giving and receiving love, and a theme through all of the research into happiness and financial contentment shows that spending money to deepen relationships is a big positive. And then finally, that becoming piece is growth, personal progress. Like, are we spending money to become healthier, smarter, more compassionate? And brings about the kind of world and the kind of life that you want to see.
Obviously, the way the book works is you have like 50 essays. And one of the first ones is make good easy and make bad hard. And that as humans, we always do the things that are easy to do, and we don't do the things that are harder to do.
If you look at the willpower research, there's really two things. Like, people who are good at sticking with their goals, they make easy good and they make bad hard. Well, what do we mean by that? We'll use diet and exercise and money. You know, maybe arguably the biggest behavioral economic intervention of all time is the Save More Tomorrow program. Mm. let's just use people's laziness and status quo proneness for their own benefit. We're going to automate the withdrawal of savings every time you get a check, and we're going to automate the escalation of that savings every time you get a bonus or a pay raise. And that way we've made it easy. We've made doing the right thing easy. You don't have to get that check every 2 weeks and go, will I or won't I save? Like, that's been automated for you. It's made the good thing easy. Personal fitness as well. People who choose a gym closer to their house are way, like, dramatically more likely to exercise than people who choose, like, perhaps a better gym that's a little further away. We see the easier that we make it, the more likely we are to do it. The second piece is inevitably when you're trying to change a behavior, there's things that you don't want to do. For people who are trying to make good financial decisions, this a lot of times looks like their media diet. You can't be filling your mind with panic-stricken negative news all the time and then hope that you're going to be a patient long-term investor.
That's the first step, right? To find the space and to find really the capacity to identify what it is that you're needing to improve on in the first place. Is there something that we can do to make that easy?
Yeah, I think you have to look at the fundamental drivers of success at whatever it is you're trying to do. You know, you think about what are the engines of a successful financial life? Well, one is maximizing the engine of your wealth, which is your personal earning potential, right? So getting all the education that you can, but then also, you know, saving at a robust level, and then being long-term and patient. The media diet is material in predicting how well we do with that. And one of the things that can be so damning about that is that it seems like watching the news is a positive, but 24-hour financial cable, you know, cable financial news is designed more to terrify than to inform.
Yes.
And so it really can be like understanding what are the fundamental drivers of the thing that you're trying to do, and then how are the different things you're working on impacting those drivers.
Yeah, absolutely. You are using the story of a British national treasure by referring to the Beatles, what the Beatles did in the mid-60s when they decided to take a break.
Each of these 50 chapters has a story and then some research. And then also in the chapter in question, I do talk about the Beatles. Now, this, I believe it was 1966. So Beatlemania is in full swing. The peak of Beatlemania, the thing to do would just be to keep writing love songs, you know, make as much money as you can. But the Beatles were captive to some of the strictures of that world. You know, if you're going to appear on Ed Sullivan, or, you know, if you're going to appear on a late night show, you got to write a 3-minute song, and you got to keep singing to your fan base, which is, you know, screaming teenage girls and young women. And they felt sort of caged by these strictures. And so what they did was they stopped touring at a time when they could have very profitably continued to tour. And they began to experiment different instruments and different lengths of songs and different songwriting styles and world music. And what you see is Sgt. Pepper's and Revolver and some of their most creative work comes out of this time. So it really took getting away from this present bias and connecting with a desired future state. We just don't want to be, you know, sort of the boy band of our era. We want to create serious art. There are so many places in life where, you know, taking on a little current pain or dissatisfaction in service of a larger future gain is the thing to do. So how do we do that? One way we have to do that is to make that future self more vivid. You know, you and I are middle-aged dads, but somewhere inside us resides an old grandpa, right? And that old grandpa is going to want the same things that we want today. Like, that old grandpa is going to want, you know, leisure and fun and good food and to see the world and to travel and do all these things. And sometimes we ignore that future reality because we don't have a vision of that future self.
The visualization point connects to what you said initially, that there's a sort of technical side, a number side associated with long-term goals. But of course, there's a bigger, more holistic picture that we've got to bear in mind as well. And what is it that would drive who would you be spending time with? Where will you be? What will you be doing day in and day out, etc.? These are the types of scenarios that you've got to get a picture of, and then a right financial conduct perhaps almost follows automatically.
I think that's such a good point, because one of the things that I found again and again in the book was that there's, you know, a practical reality to many facets of financial wellness, and then there's personal, relational, behavioral reality. The two best predictors of financial contentment are, first, how much money you have. Okay, there, you know, there's your practical reality. Yeah. But then secondarily, you need to have the right reference class, and you need to be, you know, benchmarking yourself to the right things. So we see this again and again. You know, there was another study that found people's perceptions of their wealth were predicated on the one hand on how much money they had, and then on the second hand, how generous they were. Mm. And so there's often these two sort of simultaneous needs, the technical reality and then the soulful reality, the relational behavioral reality. So I think that's a theme you see all over the place in our work, Tom.
I was wondering if there's an argument also, you know, as well, some folk who are perhaps actually making decisions almost exclusively in favor of their future self and kind of forget that they have a life today as well.
I did research where I interviewed 425 North American couples about what they thought about when they thought about money. And far and away, like by a mile, a kilometer, if you will, the thing that people thought the most about was whether money is best used to enjoy today or to secure an uncertain tomorrow. People tended to err heavily toward one camp or the other, and there were very few people who did sort of both things well. Mm. The people who were the spend today folks, like, they would look at the people who were the save for tomorrow folks and go, well, they're lame, like, you know, they're boring, they're stuffy, they're lame. And then the people who were the save for tomorrow folks would look at the spend today folks and go, they're irresponsible, that's, you know, that's not as it should be, they're being frivolous or are irresponsible stewards of wealth. But you do have to work toward a synthesis of those two ideas and say, hey, what is the right amount of saving for the future? Because that's critical. The future is also not promised. We're not guaranteed 82 years. Like, we have to balance these things.
Yeah, it's incidentally exactly the mission of this podcast, to help people make better trade-offs. So that's great. Moving on, I know you've given a lot of thought this question of how to buy happiness, or how money can buy happiness.
Money can kind of sort of buy happiness sometimes. And that is reflective of the state of the research that said that happiness tends to plateau around $75,000 US at the time, be closer to 100 today. And then there's 30% of the population for whom happiness accelerates dramatically after that first 100,000, because then you've kind of got the basics covered. You know, you can have that warm house, you can do all that. Well, and now you can start to do your hobbies, and now you can travel. And, you know, for that 30% of people, you know, you can do the stuff that makes life worth living. You can kind of elevate life. And then there's another 15% of people who seem almost impervious to the effects of money on happiness. Like, they basically have other problems. You know, maybe they have an organic mental illness, or maybe there's like situations in their life that are just impediments to their happiness that money can't really fix. For some people, I think we can safely say that low levels of wealth predictably buy misery. Yeah. But at higher levels of wealth, it depends a lot on how you spend it, what else is going on in your life, sort of honestly, your genetic endowment. We know that genetics are a huge predictor of sort of the happiness set point. People have a set point for happiness. Yeah, so it is very complicated, but we know that it helps a bit. Low levels are predictive of misery, and that at high levels, it probably matters more how you spend, save, and invest it.
I think that's a great point to break in the interview, and we'll be right back with Daniel Crosby. In our expert panel, I'm very glad to be accompanied by three colleagues of mine from Aegon. We have Steve Cameron, Director of Pensions. We have Kate Smith, Head of Pensions. And we have Andy Manson, Chief Marketing Officer at Aegon. Thank you so much for joining. If someone says, she's good with money, what do we typically mean by that? Who wants to go first?
Well, Tom, I think there's a difference between what we think people might mean and what we think good with money might be.
Yeah.
So I think people tend to be good with money means that they save lots of money, they're never in debt, they're very responsible. But I think that if we think about what's good with money, it might be more about making sure that you deal with your money short, long-term as a combination in a way that empowers what you want out of your life and you're not controlled by it. So I think good with money, I think different people will have different views and maybe need to change what good with money actually means.
Yeah,
I do think it means different things to different people. But I think for me, it's about understanding the value of money, what money can do for you, how money works for you.
Yeah.
But money isn't all everything, but it's understanding what it is and how to use it, whether that's saving or managing debt, having a budget. It means a variety of things to different people. But I think it's a really good lesson to have in life. You know, I'd say that my family, I would actually say we're all good with money.
Yeah.
And I've got two daughters who are in their 20s. I think they're really good with money compared to their peers. One is potentially much more of a saver than the other. Neither of them are big spenders on things that they will just throw in the bin or the dump, you know, the next day. That is almost inherited. Talk to Stephen, he's saying, well, you need to learn to spend a bit more.
Yeah, quite right.
I am learning to spend more. I do spend.
Andy, you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Kate and Stephen. I think ultimately it comes down to feeling in control. And I think if you feel in control of your money and the choices it allows you to make in life, I think that's a massive, massive victory. I think where it gets hard is when people don't have control of money. And then that's really associated with quite negative well-being and then it can be quite destructive. So I think it comes down to control for me.
And can I ask, because you said feeling in control, which is one of this being in control versus feeling in control. Is there something in that?
Yeah, I think there is. I think you're right. And I think you are right to pick that up. It is about a sense of control. If you're organised and you know where your money's at, however you're making choices with it, and as Stephen and Kate are saying, you know, different people make different choices at different times and that's okay. But there's a sense of control, then you're able to make active choices.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that lends people to be in control of their life. Whereas if people aren't in control of their money, actually money can very quickly create difficult situations where choices become more complex. And therefore, you know, I think feeling to be in control of your money is the route to not being in control of your life.
So there's a bit of a theme there that money is both an enabler, but also restrictor.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's about mindset, isn't it? So control is a good word. It's also a negative word, isn't it? You don't want to spend every living, breathing moment thinking about money and thinking, if only, or I should be doing this, I should be doing that. You don't want to do that. But you want it to bring you enough joy, enough fulfillment to do the things you want to do, whatever they are.
That speaks to a lot to what we are discussing, what we have discussed in this episode per sort of psychological side. Do you want to add anything, Stephen?
Yeah, I think that it is about how you feel. It's also, you need to have some realism about that. Having some basic grounding in what makes good sense, financial sense rather than money sense, if you like. Being able to try to think, it's not all about worrying about today, it's about enjoying today, so having an eye on the future. It's about saving for the future, but not doing that at such an expense that you can't enjoy today. Realising that there will be times when it's actually good money management to be going into debt helps you continue to enjoy life for a period that can allow you to achieve some of your goals, whether it's a house purchase or something else. Knowing that at least you're taking some control over, you're not doing it irresponsibly, and that you understand the consequences of your action today. Yeah. Now, that's easier said than done. I know that lots of people struggle with trying to think more than, you know, a few days ahead, let alone a few months or years ahead. So it's about trying to give people a framework that they can be prepared to do things today, not worrying about the consequences, but not doing so in an irresponsible way.
And your point there, Stephen, I think it's about goals. You mentioned goals. So it is. Everybody, if they have goals, I mean, I'm going to save up for a holiday, I'm going to save up for a house or my pension or a rainy day fund, these sort of things, but having goals and trying to achieve those by taking very small steps to actually get there. So just for, you know, paying X amount into whatever it is every month, but also paying off your debt. Don't take out high level debt and not pay it off every month, you know, pay it off. And so you'll make a saving automatically that you could put towards a holiday. So it's clever management as well, but also goal setting.
I wonder, I kind of see two concepts from what you're talking about there, because I think there's a bucket of things that are just good money management tips that people should be doing. You know, don't hold big balances on your credit cards. Don't, you know, take lots of kind of short-term debt at high interest rates, you know, and, you know, make sure you're shopping around for a better deal on your gas and electric, your insurance renewables. You know, these are all good money management tips for anybody. And having done that, then I think it then comes back to, you know, this question of balance. And I think as an industry where pensions companies historically have got it wrong is we've told people it's all about saving for the future, as opposed to recognising actually today's important as well as tomorrow. So for me, you know, in terms of kind of good money management, it comes back to how do we help people have a life well lived?
Yeah.
And helping people have a life well lived helps them make balanced choices between today and tomorrow. I think that's a critical thing. And I think it's difficult to do that without some semblance of a plan or some semblance of an idea of what you want to achieve in the future. And that doesn't have to be retirement. It could be goals before then, with maybe going back to studying or taking time out from work. But I think it's important that people start to develop some understanding of what they want to do with their life and therefore have something to anchor a plan against, to then create a balance between the money they need today and the money they need tomorrow.
I think one other aspect, one of the tips perhaps, is this idea of having some kind of cushion that can protect you when things do fluctuate. So if you've got some money set aside that you can, you know, you can draw on if you have an emergency, it can be so empowering rather than immediately going into non-managed
debt. What's a good amount, Stephen, to have for that?
Well, it's a really good question, because I read lots of things where people say, oh, you need 6 months of your salary sitting in cash, and I'm thinking, my goodness, how many people actually do that? So I want to give a number, because I think, again, it's like many things, it's very personalised to you. But, you know, you certainly don't want to be in a position where your boiler breaks down and you've got no heating. I think you just really need to look at what are the sorts of things that could hit me as an individual and how much might that cost, and just take a realistic view of whether that's a month or 3 months. But one month's better than nothing. I think some of the figures that you see banded around to me look a little bit on the top side.
Can I just pick up, how could we be good with money and yet one day look back and regret the decisions we've taken today?
Well, I'll give you an example, and it's something that actually resonates with me personally, because I didn't think that I took enough risk when I was younger. I didn't put lots of money into, I didn't put much at all into investments, for example. I suggest to Kate she should learn how to spend. Kate probably thinks I should have saved more when I was younger.
Certainly invested more in higher risk investments.
But I should definitely.
We did listen to you, Kate.
When I was younger, I wish I had taken a little more risk, because savings back when I had a young family and whatever, they were never very much there, because we spent money on family holidays because we wanted to enjoy that. We hoped that we would continue to have an income later on, so we weren't taking unwise spending decisions. But I wish I'd invested more. I wish I'd invested in a little bit more risky assets.
One of the things I've always talked about, I do invest just through ISAs, stocks and shares mainly. My children do it. They do it from a much earlier age, but they do it probably because I do it. I was probably doing it I've been doing it for at least 20 years, if not longer. But the reason I probably didn't do it early was also because there wasn't enough capital, you know, enough money left over. So it went into the pension or it paid off the mortgage. We overpaid the mortgage for a long time. But I just think it wasn't accessible to actually do these sort of investments. You know, the only way you could get to invest in stocks and shares was through your pension.
Probably similar to Kate, actually. You know, the choices that, you know, we made in my kind of 20s, 30s, I was very much focused on getting what at the time was a very large mortgage under control. And psychologically that gave me a sense of safety and security. And, you know, if you look back with the benefit of hindsight, you could say, well, when you'd left the mortgage higher, you know, equities would have grown faster than the debt, therefore I'd have been ahead financially. But that misses out on the fact that there's psychological value in paying down debt, and that significantly reduced the stress and anxiety in my life, I think, as I kind of went through my 20s and 30s. But I think against that as well, it's not all about money, isn't it? And people probably have regrets about the time they spent as much as what they did with their money. So ultimately, if what we aspire for is to have a life well lived, where we're striking a balance, then how do you spend your money in a way that kind of balances today and tomorrow?
And that's a very nice sum up of what the purpose of Money Mindshift is. So it's really about encouraging this life well lived rather than just being well off. And that's a great point to thank our panel.
Thanks, Tom.
Back with Daniel Crosby. Any rules of thumb in terms of how to spend money so as to become happier?
Yeah, I think Dunn and Norton did really great work on this that I think is still widely cited. But, you know, what they talk about are a few things. Giving money away reliably buys happiness. And people misunderstand that. People think that spending money on themselves will buy them more happiness than being generous. That's not the case. We also see that buying back your time or getting out of work that you hate buys happiness. One of my favorite uses of money is to have someone else cut my lawn. You know, paying a high school kid to cut my lawn is money well spent for me. And I think a lot of times people are reticent to spend money to free up time because they go, well, I could do that. There's also research. There's research that I cite in the book that I found fascinating. You know, cars are when people have a windfall or they reach a certain level of wealth, buying a nice car is high on the list. But cars don't buy us much happiness usually. But people who buy cars to join auto clubs experience a lot of happiness because now they have a place to go on Saturday and talk about their hobby. And now they have a new friend group and they have, people to go on cruises with and talk about cars. And so, you know, anything we can do to deepen relationships and create memories again is maybe the most powerful thing we can do with our money.
Right. Perhaps in the spirit of trading off the needs of the present me versus future me. Say there's someone who's not on a low level of income, but gets a higher paying job offer. How should they think about this?
Okay, yeah. So that's a great question, because I think a lot of people wrestle with this. You have to think about what the trade-offs are. Even an extra 15 minutes each way of commute time is worth a lot of money in terms of happiness. Commuting is sort of a universally loathed human experience. You know, the extra 15 minutes in the car, you know, that extra half an hour of life each day. Well, yeah, that's 4 hours a week. You know, it adds up. So as a general rule, look, if it's apples to apples, then go take the money. But if you have to work more, stress more, drive more, if you have to give up much more of your life in exchange for that money, I think you're paying a pretty dear price.
Let's take a sharp right turn, and I give you a bit of a cryptic prompt, Daniel. I hate going to the dentist. I have an appointment due. Where do you want to take this from here?
Okay, yes. I too hate going to the dentist. So in one of the chapters, there was really a micro and a macro reason why I wrote the book. The micro reason has to do with teeth. Okay. I, for a few months, was in enormous amount of pain. I was having migraines, sensitivity to heat and cold and light, and just really debilitating headaches. And, you know, I go online and I look up, hey, I'm, you know, in my 40s, I'm having these headaches. What is it? And so I go and I say, look, you know, the number one likely cause of this is a tooth problem. And so I go to my dentist twice, and the dentist x-rays, taps around, blows air, you know, nothing. you know, like nothing's wrong with your teeth. And, you know, I go to a psychiatrist and a neurologist and a sinus specialist and I get a brain scan. Nothing. And the pain is just worsening. And there's one day where my wife is driving me to the hospital and I'm sitting in the front seat of her car and I'm crying and I think I'm dying and I can't figure out what's wrong with me. And it hurts so much. And I said to her, I would give away all our money if I could just make this go away. 2 weeks later, I'm having a sandwich with a friend and my tooth just splits in half. Yeah, I had just split perfectly healthy molars in half. And that was what was causing the pain. But they were, the dentist missed it. But the experience stuck with me. This experience of saying, if you don't have your health, you have nothing. And so I wrote this chapter, Health is Wealth. You know, I found that people who exercise do better financially than those who don't. There's sort of a spillover effect of that discipline has sort of a spillover effect. People who go to therapy make dramatically more money than people who don't. And that is a wild finding. Most of us work at where your EQ and your ability to manage your stress and interact well with other people and be a good team player is at least as predictive of your ascension through an organization as your, again, your technical skills.
Yeah, great. Okay, fantastic. The earlier, I think this is brought in the same space. Earlier in the week, I saw a post of yours where you said something about anxiety and that, of course, anxiety makes you feel bad, but that there is a signal or something that you can take from, a message that you can take from the anxiety.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to go with my favorite philosopher here, Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard. One of his most famous quotes is that anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. Anxiety was often a signal that something was physically dangerous, right? I mean, it's the leaves rustling in the bush and is it a snake and all that. In modern life, anxiety, though, is not often a signal of anything except that we may need to do something different and it can propel us in a good direction. And I think there's a real move to suppress every negative emotion, to medicate it away, to talk it away, to reason it away. And my thought there was that, hey, a lot of times your discomfort, your anxiety, it's a signal that you were built for more, that you were built for different. Like the unease you feel may be the delta between what you should be doing and what you ought to be doing, yeah, like who you are and who you ought to be. Sometimes you feel bad because you could be doing better. And so I think sometimes we need to sit with that anxiety long enough to say, what's the signal here? What is this telling me? And how can I live a more fulfilled life as a result of this, not just, you know, flush it or get rid of it.
Daniel, I think we learned a lot here in terms of how to be good with money and touched on many different aspects of this. I have one more question for you, Daniel, and I want to invite our listeners to reflect on their own money mindset and their money personality. And that's why I ask my guests how they would describe their money personality.
I'm the son of a financial advisor, and my father, when my dad got his job on the day that I was born, like on the literal day that I was born, he had dropped out of grad school. He was mowing lawns for a living. My mother worked at McDonald's while she was pregnant with me. They were very young when they had me. They had nothing. And then my dad, literally the day that I was born, got his job as a financial advisor. But anyone who knows the work of a financial advisor knows that work has a very high attrition rate. There's like an 80% failure rate. And that the few, at least in the States, and that the first couple of years are not highly remunerative. You know, when I was young, my dad did not make much money. Now, I mean, now he does, but when I was a kid, we didn't have much. And so my early formative memories of money are, I mean, I don't want to overstate it. We were like lower middle class when I was a kid. I was not going hungry, but there was some tension and some scarcity, right? And so those are some of my early and most formative memories. And I carry those with me. I think the way that many of us do, those early childhood memories have an oversized impact on who we are as adults. My brother, who is 12 years younger than me, grew up in a very different financial reality and has a very different financial mindset. As a result, he grew up with more abundance than I had. But what's interesting, though, is I've tried to shift that, because my natural impulse is to work hard and save hard and not to spend a lot of money. But my dad, who is my advisor, has encouraged me, and I have listened both to him and through the research that I've done, to spend more in the ways that we're talking about today, to spend more on relationships, on seeing the world, on deepening family ties. And my dad has really encouraged me to spend, you know, my financial advisor has encouraged me to spend more money than I would have otherwise. So I'm a reformed, I'm a reforming, you know, tightwad that is learning, that is learning to spend money in ways that, you know, give rise to happiness. And this year, like, my family is just traveling all over the place, because we see, you know, I have a child who will be 16 here. We got her for two more summers. And then, you know, most of our time with her will be spent. Yeah, most of our, like, two more years, and then most of our time with her is gone. And so we feel some urgency about that. And, you know, through my own research and because of the encouragement of my dad, I spend a lot more than I would otherwise. But the other story with my parents, my mom has some very severe health complications and she's in a wheelchair. And so when I was young and my parents were, you know, building wealth and didn't have a lot of money, we didn't do much. But even as they begin to have more, they still had that sort of mentality locked in, save, save, save. Now they have lots of money and they have limited freedom because of the realities of her health problems. And so, you know, they've both encouraged me to say, hey, look, achieve more balance here. So I've seen it in my own life, the ways that, you know, even something that seems positive like that work hard, save hard mentality can become overextended. You never know what life's going to give you. And I've tried to learn the lesson that my parents have tried to teach me in that respect.
Daniel, this has been absolutely amazing. If people want to learn more about you, want to find out more about you, where should they go?
Yeah, I hope people will go read The Soul of Wealth. My podcast is called Standard Deviation.
I thank you so much for your time. It's been an amazing chat. Great to see you again.
My pleasure. Always good to be with you, friend.
Would you say that you're good with money?
I never used to be. I particularly, I would probably say before 25 was probably a bit irresponsible. Used to just spend money with paycheck to paycheck. But as you get older, I've become a lot more responsible, took a lot more interest in financial matters and kind of, you know, stocks and shares, savings accounts.
I'm pretty good with money. I'm a bit of a serious saver, probably an oversaver. If anything, I think I'm sometimes too cautious with money, and that I could maybe learn to spend a little more and enjoy it a bit more. I think I'm a bit overcautious.
I budget every month with my wife. We have a spreadsheet which she doesn't like, and we go through it on a monthly basis, make sure that we've got everything that we need for the house, predominantly the family stuff, and then we sort of separate out what sort of mandatory and then what do we have left to play with effectively.
It's nice that you do that with your partner.
It's very much a concerted effort. I think she doesn't enjoy it, mainly because she likes to think about holidays and things that I try and rein back. But no, we do it together. You know, everything that we have is joint, and we treat it that way. And you know, we sit down and we talk about it, and we make sure that, you know, she knows where everything is, and I know where everything is from her side as well. We keep everything as joint as we can, but obviously sometimes policies and things like that are.
Would you say that you're good with money?
I think I'm okay with money. I think I rely on the good practices and logic of my partner. Between us, we're good with money. She's good at organising it and planning it. I'm quite good at spending it.
I guess my parents came from working class background, and then my dad had gone to uni and become an accountant. And I think so as a result, we were always quite, there was always a bit of focus in the sense of, like, you were given pocket money, and if you saved up your pocket money, you got something. You didn't get something if you didn't save up pocket money. And I think that's something that's kind of maybe been privileged in the sense that I've had that.
That's it for today's episode of Money Mindshift. I hope this gave you not just food for thought, but also a way to think differently about money, about mindset, and how those two things interact. If something resonated with you, take a moment to ask yourself not just what am I spending on, but why? Not just how much am I saving, but what for? Because the goal isn't just to be financially savvy, it's to be financially self-aware. For this episode, thank you so much to my guest, Daniel Crosby, the panel and our contributors. And most of all, thank you for listening to our very first Money Mindshift podcast. We hope you will subscribe to follow us on what I think will be an exciting journey together. But until then, I'm Dr. Tom. See you around.
I believe that being well off isn't the same as living well. That's the Money Mindshift with Dr. Tom Mattar.